Support for AHLA comes from Stout, a global investment bank and advisory firm specializing in corporate finance, transaction advisory, valuation, financial disputes, claims, and investigations. They serve a range of clients, from public corporations to privately held companies in numerous industries. For more information, visit stout.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's AHLA podcast on the psychedelic boom in the healthcare industry. My name is Lisa Gora, and I'm a partner with the national law firm of Epstein, Becker & Green, where I lead the firm's psychedelic and cannabis practice areas. And today I'm joined here by my colleague, Richard Chang, who's a managing member of Ritter Spencer & Chang law firm located in Texas. And we're excited to be here and discuss this interesting and now burgeoning area of psychedelics. Richard, if you want to share a little bit about your background as well, and then I'll provide a little summary.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Lisa. As Lisa previously mentioned, I'm a attorney and managing member at Ritter Spencer Chang. It's based in Addison, Texas. It's a law firm of about 8 attorneys. We have a variety of different services. Certainly, healthcare and alternative substances are two of the probably bigger and stronger areas of practice in our firm. That's certainly the term that we've used at our firm, just because as we've seen, alternative substances, or some people will call it emerging therapies, you're really encapsulating a lot of different types of different industries, ranging from cannabis to ketamine to kratom, under one roof, if you will. But I'm excited to be here to talk about how some of these areas of practice has incorporated into my healthcare practice, and happy to just dive into it. But just know, while we may mention cannabis or something, or reference ketamine, the focus today is on psychedelics and psilocybin, and we can certainly have a frank discussion about that.
Yeah, great.
Thanks. So, Lisa, why don't I just kick us off by asking you a few questions? I think the format of this podcast is just us having an open dialogue and discussion about a variety of different things. So, you know, you previously mentioned to me during our conversations, over the past decade, psychedelic substances and efforts to investigate potential new treatment modalities, you know, it certainly gained some significant attention and publicity. What do you think are some of the driving factors or driving forces behind the resurgence of interest in psychedelics, particularly really in the past 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, that's a great question, Richard, and a great way to get us started and kicked off here is I think what I've seen is that there's been just this great interest in psychedelic medicine. And it's been soaring over the recent years due to the growing need for access to effective and safer treatment for certain diagnoses, you know, during a time of increased scrutiny over the dangerous side effects of opioids. You know, we've all heard about the opioid pandemic and epidemic where patients have been seen to be prescribed opioids to treat certain indications over a certain period of time. And other just traditional pharmaceuticals that, you know, patients are feeling are not really getting them to the end resolution of comfort that they want. So we have that need for safer access to other different types of, like you mentioned earlier, emerging therapeutics. And because of the need to find alternative therapeutic treatments that could hopefully be more effective than existing prescription drugs, you know, some of which that carry the risk of dependence, as we've heard. And in the time of, you know, mental crisis that was a result out of COVID, it's certainly this interest in finding alternative emerging therapies has really risen. And then there's been the expanding body of clinical research that has been developing that's suggested that mind-altering substances like MDMA and psilocybin are effective at treating a broad range of mental health conditions, ranging from depression and anxiety to eating disorders and post-traumatic stress disorder. And so, given all of those needs and then the interest in having clinical research that has been conducted, we've seen a few noteworthy occurrences over the past 10 years that I just wanted to take a moment to identify from a federal perspective. And that's ranging back to 2018, we had the Federal Food and Drug Administration grants Compass Pathways a breakthrough therapy designation for its test and use of psilocybin with therapy as a way to help people with treatment-resistant depression. And a breakthrough designation granted by the FDA is something where when evidence suggests that a drug may be a substantial clinical improvement over existing therapies. And so again, it goes back to the desire for patients now to find emerging therapies outside of the traditional pharmaceutical route. Then in 2019, we had FDA approve a psychedelic drug called Spravato, which is esketamine, which we'll talk to a little bit, which is a nasal spray for use in treatment-resistant depression. We had in 2021 the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, also known as MAPS, published its phase three results for a clinical trial using MDMA, which is another psychedelic. And that was in conjunction with psychotherapy to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Then in 2021, the DEA twice increased its production quota for manufacturing of the Schedule I substance psilocybin for research and development requirements and so forth, which also ties into hopefully steps for the FDA to approve certain new drug products. So overall, what I'd like to just identify in at least this segment of kind of historical development is that there's been various developments from the clinical research perspective, as well as having seen dozens of universities and research centers all across the United States conduct studies on the safety and efficacy of psychedelic-assisted therapies. And it's very well-known universities such as Johns Hopkins that created a Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. We have Mount Sinai, NYU Grossman School of Medicine, University of California, University of Wisconsin. So there's been a lot of developments over the past 10 years, and those are just a few that we're capable of highlighting during this podcast. So it's great to see that development from a federal perspective. But what I'd like to also get into next, though, is what about the advances in the psychedelic area as it relates to individual states, Richard? Can you speak to some of those advancements and shifts of what we've seen from a state perspective rather than just on the federal level?
Yeah, sure, Lisa. There's so many ways to unpack this, right? I mean, first of all, the psychedelics as a whole, I like to just step back and just tell the audience that whoever's listening to this, psychedelics encompasses a lot of different forms of psychedelics. Psychedelics as a whole is considered a hallucinogen and has been primarily used to address a myriad of different types of conditions, but really what such as PTSD, right? And so some of the effects of psychedelics, if you will, can produce changes in perception, mood, cognitive processes, and so forth. It can affect one's individual's level of reflectiveness in both physically and psychologically, and how they process information. But some common forms of psychedelics is include DMT, LSD, psilocybin, most of us have heard of, which AKA magic mushrooms. So there's different forms of psychedelics. Even peyote is considered a psychedelic. And why it's so individualized on a state by state level is because different states have passed different laws on how the scope of how psychedelics are used. So as a comparison, in Texas, which is where I am, the only bill that's been passed, the only way that psychedelics can really be used is in the form of research. You cannot use it in the form of treatment in clinics and so forth, with the exception of ketamine, right? Because, well, part of also is because ketamine is now a Schedule III controlled substance under the Controlled Substances Act, whereas psilocybin is still a Schedule I. On a state level, you have different licensing structures and different regulatory frameworks. I know that certainly one of the things that we've talked about is if ketamine, because ketamine is a form of a psychedelic, if a group of physicians were to launch a ketamine clinic in Texas, it's certainly very different than how they would do it in, say, New Mexico because of corporate practice of medicine laws. So, in addition to some of the regulations and rules and both federal and state laws they have to consider in terms of psychedelics from a compliance and regulatory consideration, they also have to consider how if there are any state rules on how it should be delivered. Some states will allow you to use psychedelics in the form of teas, and some other states will not. Some states will allow you to use it by allowing, say, a licensed facilitator to administer it. Other states won't. So there's so many different variations on how psychedelics can be consumed and administered from state to state. In addition to corporate practice of medicine, or really because of corporate practice of medicine, in states like Texas or California or New York, that also changes the how investments and how businesses are run, because to the extent that there are any investors or any investment platforms that want that's willing to explore this area, such as ketamine clinics, how they structure the deal or the investment in Texas may be very different than, say, again, I'm going to pick on New Mexico because New Mexico does not have a corporate practice medicine laws. In fact, I'm doing a transaction there right now, and I've never seen this before, but the physician's practice that we're acquiring on behalf of my client, one of the owners is actually a personal injury attorney based here in Texas. That sounds a little odd, but it's completely legal in New Mexico. Whereas here in Texas, because of CPOM laws, you may have to use a couple of different models that can be con that can that that's commonly used that complies with CPOM laws, such as an MSO friendly PC model or MPHO model. So it does vary from state to state, and because of the variation, it also impacts other areas.
Yeah, and even one thing that I want to take a step back on is, the designation of a Schedule I drug for those that may not be all too familiar with that. Richard just discussed ketamine, which is a Schedule III drug, as opposed to all other psychedelics that are classified as Schedule I. And it psychedelic drugs being categorized as a Schedule I is really one of the main obstacles to studying and development of psychedelic substances, such as MDMA or psilocybin, as Richard mentioned. And a Schedule I drug, as opposed to Schedule III, which is what ketamine is, ketamine as a Schedule III can be prescribed by healthcare practitioners, and it can be prescribed and dispensed through medical practices, right? As opposed to psilocybin, which right now nowhere in the United States can it be just prescribed by a doctor for a specific condition, at least in a legally valid way. And that's because the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, through the Federal Controlled Substances Act, has classified an entire range of drugs as Schedule I, except again for ketamine. And what this Schedule I designation classification means is that the DEA has deemed these drugs as having no currently accepted medical use, and/or having a high potential for abuse and lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision. So why I highlight that is, even though these psychedelic drugs are in the classification of Schedule One, being seemingly not having any recognized medicinal benefit, you still see, states that are looking to approve certain state legalized frameworks, which Richard and I work with all the time, even from just a cannabis perspective, because cannabis is also still a Schedule One drug. And yet we've seen a slew of states regulate or approve state regulated medicinal cannabis markets as well as adult use cannabis markets, right?
Yeah, so Lisa, you bring up a lot of really good points. I do want to mention that because you talked about how ketamine is being administered, but let's take MDMA for example, right? I think the FDA, and I only mention this because I think that this gives us and people in the industry some hope in because FDA has agreed to an expedited review with their new drug application for MDMA, which is relatively a good sign, and it looks it's an indication that the climate of how the federal government is viewing psychedelics is trending towards a consideration of being considered a legitimate form of treatment for patients, particularly with what MDMA is really designed to do is to offer some relief for individuals with PTSD and anxiety and depression. But let's shift the discussion over to where you are. I mean, you're in New Jersey and close to Manhattan. You're in the bustling area of the Northeast Coast. What's going on there? Is there anything specific when it comes to psychedelics, in your part of the country?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not as exciting as what's going on in Oregon or Colorado, which I'll briefly get to. But the point is to know that there's been development in multiple states with regards to introduction of bills related to psilocybin use. So I'm located in New Jersey, and I practice from kind of a home state of New Jersey and New York. And in New Jersey, in the 2022-2023 legislative session, our Senate president introduced what's called the Psilocybin Behavioral Health Access and Services Act. And it's an act to authorize the production and use of psilocybin to, again, to promote health and wellness. The act also decriminalizes the possession of psilocybin or a specific amount of psilocybin and expunges past offenses involving psilocybin production, possession, use, and distribution. So what I like to highlight there is that even though this has only been introduced into the legislative session as of last year, it was actually just reintroduced by the Senate president earlier this year, January 9th, 2024. And there's an expectation that this act or some amended version of the act will become law in 2024. And the regulated framework that this bill has taken, at least in its current form, is very, very similar to what's going on in Oregon. And Oregon, for those that are not aware, is one of the most progressive states when it comes to psilocybin. It's one of two states that has fully decriminalized and implemented a state regulated framework of psilocybin service center model, which is a business model whereby any type of individual, not just a healthcare practitioner, would be able to own a psilocybin service center and kind of carry out in one way or another a kind of like a psychiatry practice. They'd be able to dispense psilocybin that they receive from a state licensed psilocybin manufacturer. And Oregon right now has that business model. There are psilocybin service centers in operation. There are psilocybin manufacturers in Oregon that have a license to manufacture those products. And New Jersey has proposed a very, very similar framework at this point in time. So we may very well see something similar to what's going on in Oregon right now. And it's and so that's exciting for the fact that we at least have Oregon to look to as the example. So again, we're looking to see if something like that will be approved and made law within the next 12 months. In New York, which again is right next door, New York has actually proposed a similar bill from like a rec an adult use perspective, whereby psilocybin can be run through these types of service centers that don't have to be owned by healthcare practitioners. But it also, more interestingly, proposed a clinical research bill that would provide for medical use of psilocybin. And it's that medical bill for the use of psilocybin that's actually making more traction in New York as opposed to the adult use recreational type of bill that we see here in New Jersey and is operating in Oregon. And in New York, it's an act that is to amend the public health law and allow for the medical use of psilocybin within more a healthcare practice regimen, whereby the entities would have to be owned by healthcare practitioners. So it's more looking to set up in New York a medical pathway for patients to access psilocybin coupled with assisted therapies, with the use of healthcare practitioners. And that's the real distinction between what is going on in Oregon and what we may see on the East Coast, is that these psilocybin bills be more medicalized, whereby it would affect, my clients and Richard's clients from a healthcare perspective, where this type of substance would hopefully, from what I gather, just what I'm hearing in the political world, is that it would be run more as a medical practice as opposed to just a regular business model that we've seen in Oregon. But it's still up in the air for what would actually be approved. But it's great seeing the layout of the two different types of business models. So that's New York and New Jersey. And from another statewide perspective, I would just like to highlight that Colorado is actually the second state that approved a state-regulated framework to operate a similar business model as we currently see operational in Oregon. So it's Oregon first, Colorado second. And then we have a slew of states all over the US that have proposed bills about decriminalizing the use of psilocybin, such as Massachusetts, Michigan, Washington has decriminalized it in selected municipalities, DC. So we'll only continue to see this development, very similar to what we saw with cannabis. And that's why we are capable of seeing the parallels between the two industries, cannabis as opposed to, psychedelics and vice versa. So while talking about that expansion across the US, like we've seen with cannabis and having touched on some of the federal perspectives, Richard, what I wanted to get into next is, if you can speak to a little bit about the contravention between state and federal law, that dichotomy between Schedule I substances being illegal to be manufactured, possessed, and distributed. However, now we're seeing the first state, Oregon, implement an actual program whereby they are manufacturing a Schedule I substance. Can you talk to that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. Lisa, as I previously mentioned, just a few minutes ago, that listen, let's get something out in the open, right? I mean, psilocybin, aka mushroom, magic mushrooms, it's still a Schedule I drug. Psychedelics as a whole, with the exception of ketamine, it's still federally illegal. And depending on which state you're in, the states have their own Controlled Substances Act as well. So you have that correlation where certain states, such as Texas, we have the Texas Controlled Substances Act, that if you're caught with magic mushrooms on you, it's I believe they classify as a penalty type penalty, or a group, I'm sorry, a group two penalty. And that's defined in the Texas Controlled Substances Act. And of course, as we all know, as a Schedule One substance under the CSA, it's essentially saying that there's a high level of abuse, or there's a high chance and risk for abuse, but with almost no medical benefits. That's currently how they're classified on the federal level. Of course, we've seen states have varying degrees of opinions on how they see psilocybin. And as you previously just mentioned, Colorado and Oregon certainly are two states that are on the cutting edge of this. I believe Colorado legalized psychedelics, I believe five different forms in 2022, and of course Oregon being kind of the pioneers in 2020. So you're seeing that trend of ever since 2020, and now we're 4 years, really 3.5, 4 years in. More states are either actively producing legislation, or they're decriminalizing it to some degree, and even some municipalities such as Minneapolis, the mayor Jacob Frey there issued an executive order just summer of last year that addresses the natural use of or the use of natural psychedelics. I believe Minneapolis is the first city in the upper Midwest to do that. So you have like these different layers of local, state, and federal, and then so you have conflict of laws issues, and we saw that with cannabis, right? Cannabis had very well continue really continues to have similar challenges because if you're taking a Schedule One substance across state lines through interstate commerce, that becomes a federal issue. You can be prosecuted for money laundering under RICO. There's some other state federal penalties that the DEA and the Department of Justice can get involved with. But then you have these states that have legalized some of these Schedule One drugs, and different states have their different rules. So some states will have it written that they will allow these Schedule One drugs to be brought into their states, and other states have legalized it. Or in the world of cannabis, they've created laws to allow adult use. They will not allow that. So you have all these different states that even have legalized it in certain forms, but it conflicts with other a neighboring state. And so you have to look at all these different state laws and federal laws. And of course, even just because you're complying with state law, it doesn't prevent the federal government, such as the DEA, from coming in and taking enforcement actions. Now, the question then becomes, what are the chances, or what are the risks? What are the legitimate risks? How is the federal government or the state government is prioritizing on enforcement actions, and what type of penalties are at issue? I think one thing to point out, Lisa, is, if you really take a step back and think about a comparison between psychedelics and cannabis had this really interesting, colorful history leading up to it through the 1910s all the way through the 20s, 30s, and so forth. You have you have some issues with federal enforcement agencies essentially stigmatizing it through the initiatives carried out by Harry Anslinger, and then we have movies on it like such as Reefer Madness. But psychedelics didn't really have that. To some degree, there was some bad publicity in some ways, but it doesn't have that same rich history that cannabis did. And because of that, it was it's e I think it's easier for certain states to progressively move faster to pass certain bills to address psychedelic issues than it was for cannabis. Not to mention that cannabis kind of set the stage, and you already took this Control One, or I'm sorry, Schedule One controlled substance, and different states are legalizing it. So as a society, we look at that and we think, oh my gosh, we can't believe we're doing that. But then after a few years of adult use or medical use legislation that's passed, we realize, well, the world hasn't really changed that much. I mean, yeah, it's changed a little bit, but it's not like it's not like the world has come to an end just simply because adult use of cannabis was legalized. So that kind of set the stage, if you will, to tee off on psychedelics, say, okay, well, if we can do this for cannabis, why couldn't we do this for psychedelics? And then you couple that with the fact that it didn't really have all those that rich history, the stigma behind it, where it was scrutinized more. And as evidence, in Texas at least, we passed a medical cannabis bill back in 2015, and it's been what, 9 years, and we still only have 8 different qualifying conditions. So it progressed slowly. And I psych, the a psychedelics bill was passed, I believe, in 2021 for research, and that happened pretty quickly, almost overnight. And that's an indication that of what I was just talking about, that it seems like this society as a whole has accepted psychedelics at a faster rate than it did with cannabis. And so I think part of that will also play into how, if there is a conflict of laws between state and federal, it'll have an impact on how the federal government will take enforcement action, if any.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Richard, that I think psychedelics will be taking a similar approach in terms of a state perspective, with each state coming up with its own type of regulated framework. And like we saw in the cannabis space, right? Each state really started with legalizing cannabis use from the medicinal perspective, whereby businesses would be able to dispense cannabis for first medicinal use, and you had to have, the patients have to have a medicinal card under their state's medicinal program, whether it's through the Department of Health or whatnot. And then once that was accepted, then we saw adult use recreational coming around. So here we're seeing, as though I think psychedelics don't necessarily have to take start with that medicinal framework from the beginning, from what we're seeing in Oregon, which is just a regular business model. But there is more acceptance of that psychedelic area and need for the use of these types of substances. And I think it's kind of it, there's the legal pathways for psychedelic use to be implemented in each state, but there's also then this commercial need for patients to want to have this different access to medicines and therapeutics that I think are moving at a faster rate than the legal frameworks can be set up, right? You always have public that's asking for access to different types of medicines, but then it just takes longer for the legal side to catch up with that commercialization of psychedelic products and such. So I think, the world wants to try and see if they can get access to different types of psychedelics, while us as attorneys, have to make sure that it's being done in an approved manner, whether it's through FDA approval and or, state regulated model.
Right. No, I agree. One thing I'll point out is, even we brief both of us briefly mentioned Colorado and Oregon. And of course, in Oregon, in 2020, they passed the Oregon Psilocybin Services Act. And in 2022, Colorado passed what's called the Natural Medicine Health Act, both of which address their respective psilocybin or psychedelics framework in each state. And even within those two states, right, they have, they obviously are the two kind of up and coming and cutting edge states in this particular area. Even within those two states, if you read the language, it's interesting. They have some overlap, but then there's some distinct differences too. And from what I can tell, Oregon is really driven in this natural healing and wellness, and it's almost like a process of healing and addressing an individual's holistic approach, and it takes on a holistic approach in addressing the entire individual. And they use the words like facilitator, and the facilitator is really the one that you meet with, and then and they make it a point to point out that It's not really like a products focused program. It's really like a process focused program. And you know, you meet with the facilitator. You may end up eating whole dried mushrooms or taking an extract or whatever. But if you look at the language in Colorado, so both, like we said, that both states have legalized it, but they're taking on somewhat different approaches. And again, while I think the overlap is that you can't, unlike cannabis, you can't, you can just walk into a dispensary and pick up the products. With psilocybin, you're really meeting with like the facilitator or the licensed professional in this regulatory framework. And you set an appointment, you actually go through this entire like healing process. And but in Colorado, they're taking more of a medicinal or healthcare type approach. At least that's what it seems like to me. But I just like to point out that even with these two states that have legalized it, they're taking on somewhat different approaches. With that said, Lisa, what do you see the future is for psychedelics? Do you see any major changes or any up and coming major shifts in the law, or how do what does it look like in your crystal ball?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that this is certainly still the start of what we're bound to see in psychedelics. We're going to see so many different types of stakeholders get involved in the psychedelic area, whether it's from a clinical research perspective, whether it's just through a business perspective of investors getting involved. We have healthcare practitioners that will continue to operate medical practices, and recommend or dispense these types of drugs when they are approved, by the FDA. And then obviously just, you have entrepreneurs that will look to get involved in this space. So a lot of different developments that I see in the future, but with all that being said, I do look at it as an area of which, the healthcare practices will be involved in. And while progress is being made in all the different hurdles of legalization and approval, I think that there's still the consideration of who will pay for these treatments using psychedelics. So I know, at least from my healthcare client perspectives, if they're gearing up to try and use these types of substances in their practices, which they'll certainly want to get involved in, even if it's from an investigational perspective, and prescribe it off-label like ketamine is currently. I think the question for patients and providers will be whether insurance providers will agree to reimburse providers who prescribe psychedelic therapy to patients. And my hope is that we will see coverage for these substances at some point. So most notably, the American Medical Association has approved a temporary set of CPT codes for psychedelic therapies. And the CPT codes that the AMA recently approved, they're actually CPT-3 codes. And Category 3 CPT codes are a set of temporary codes that help track the use of emerging technologies, services, emerging therapies. But it does not constitute a finding of support or lack thereof by the AMA with regard to, clinical efficacy and safety and such. And it does not necessarily mean that payers will be providing coverage. The new codes do allow qualified healthcare providers to ask a patient's insurance to reimburse them for the psychedelic treatment they prescribe. However, again, the approval or publishing of the CPT-3 codes does not automatically mean that insurance companies will agree to reimburse for psychedelic therapies. I think, in that world of the insurances, the experts will say that the Food and Drug Administration approval, if there is approval by the FDA of psychedelics, will certainly be key for insurance companies to consider reimbursement. So I think with that being said, there's certainly companies out there that are looking to lead the path for obtaining reimbursement for these types of medicines. You can look at a company called Entheia that's a third-party administrator to provide reimbursement for self-funded employer plans that are looking to cover these types of medicines. There's a company called Benevis Health out there that's looking to provide coverage for plans that want to provide reimbursement for their employees who use cannabis. So I think that that's the next wave, but only one of many things that we'll see in this industry. Now, what about you, Richard? His final thoughts. What do you see as the future for psychedelics?
I think a couple things will happen, right? I think different states will still continue to look at opportunities for more research and gathering more data, and to have some quantitative and quantitative data to show the efficacy of psychedelics. So as more states jumps on the research aspect, the R&D, I think more opportunities will be created from that. Potentially even some investments, right? Because of that, and because of the collected data, I think that makes a very compelling argument for different advocacy groups that could impact the perspectives of Health and Human Services, or the Department of Health and Human Services, which, as you know, has an impact on whether or not a substance is rescheduled under the Controlled Substances Act, as we've seen with cannabis, because Health and Human HHS made a recommendation after its studies on cannabis. As of last year, they made a recommendation to the DEA for cannabis to be rescheduled from a 1 to a 3. I think there's going to be more money involved. Based on my understanding, is that more than $560 million have been raised through venture capital firms. At least this is what I saw according to PitchBook magazine. And as of right now, MDMA and psilocybin, they both have obtained, quote, breakthrough status from the FDA. And as I said earlier, the MDMA has already been granted an expedited review on their new drug application. I think furthermore that there's some other interesting data that I found on the through the MAPS Public Benefit Corporation. They've actually raised more than $130 million on the study and the focus of MDMA since 1986. So you do see some money and some research going on, and because of that, I think it has an overall impact on what the federal government will do. I think it's a matter of time. I do think it'll be on a faster track than cannabis. And as this industry grows, you're going to naturally see a progression of it bleeding into healthcare, as we've seen with not only with cannabis, but also with ketamine. And part of that is also because he got rescheduled to a 3. And of course, there's a trickle-down effect, and it's going to impact clinicians and how different licensing boards are going to have to change some of their guidance and some of their rules and regulations on their licensed professionals, their scope of practice, and whether or not they're going to regulate how they prescribe or how they recommend some of these substances. We've seen in California developing new laws that addresses anti-kickback issues and physician self-referral laws that's specific in that state. Now, will it happen with psychedelics? I think so. I think it's going to be more of treated more of a like a medicine, and it's going to be more and more incorporated into the lives of physicians and how healthcare is delivered and how medicine is going to be viewed.
Yeah, I agree. Those are all great projections and thoughts. So thank you so much, Richard, for joining me today. And thank you for everyone out there for joining us in examining the history of psychedelic substances and allowing us to discuss the evolving legal and regulatory landscape in the area of psychedelic substances, which will only continue. So thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to AHLA Speaking of Health Law wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about AHLA and the educational resources available to the health law community, visit AmericanHealthLaw.org.